Center of San Francisco. On the next Bina, authors of the new book, Noise, Daniel Kahneman, Olivier Siboney, and Cass Sunstein, offer remedies to reduce bias and ultimately make better decisions. Hear all about Noise on Bina, Thursday at 2 p.m. here on 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco.
Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. My co-host tonight, Emmy-nominated legal and political analyst Dean Johnson. Tonight we wrap up our discussion of the Supreme Court's historic 2021-2022 session. What did the court do? What are the implications of its landmark decisions overturning Roe v. Wade, striking down gun control laws, and cutting back the role of government agencies? Is there more to come in the next term? And most important, what does this mean for our everyday lives? Dean?
Good evening, everyone. You know, the Supreme Court has just ended its session for this year, and I think we're all breathing a collective sigh of relief. As Jeff mentioned, the big case this year was Dobbs, which eliminated the federal right to abortion. California's response to Dobbs has been massive and unprecedented, as have other states. I'm going to try to summarize the chaotic legal situation that we're facing right now, but I want to caution everybody. This is a situation that's in flux. The legal landscape is changing virtually every day. So what I say tonight might not necessarily be true tomorrow. Very quickly, when Dobbs was announced, three states on the West Coast, Washington, Oregon, and California, announced that they were forming a coalition to protect women's reproductive rights. Governor Newsom, in order to implement some of the goals of the coalition, and without waiting for legislative action, issued an executive order, which essentially prohibited cooperation by any state employee in any proceeding that would impose civil, criminal, or professional liability for anybody who received or provided an abortion. It didn't take long for the legislature to react, though. They very quickly passed AB 2091, which prohibited the release of any identifying information of anyone who had sought an abortion within California. AB 1666 was quickly signed into law and created what may be a constitutional conflict that we'll see in the Supreme Court next year, because California has now announced that if there is any judgment, whether civil, criminal, or otherwise, against anyone for receiving or providing reproductive services, we will not give those judgments full faith and credit. We will not honor those out-of-state judgments in California. And finally, and perhaps most significantly, voters will be able to be heard on the issue of reproductive rights in the November election, as there will be a proposition on the ballot that will amend our California state constitution to incorporate reproductive rights explicitly as a fundamental state constitutional right. In the meantime, state lawyers in trigger law states where there are anti-abortion statutes that went into effect in Louisiana, South Carolina, Arizona, North Dakota, Florida, Texas, Mississippi, Oklahoma, and West Virginia have challenged those laws under various theories with mixed success. And finally, my favorite, something that we almost joked about a week ago, we asked whether the Supreme Court's expansive reading of the notion of religious liberty could be used as an opening wedge to challenge bans on abortion. And in fact, a rabbi in Miami, Florida, filed a lawsuit saying that we in the Jewish faith recognize a woman's right to reproductive freedom, and to ban us from exercising that right is a violation of our religious liberty. He's now been joined by a Unitarian minister and a Buddhist monk who have filed their own lawsuits. Jeff?
So tonight, in the first half hour, all three of us, Dean Johnson, Ann Voights, and myself, will be very anxious to hear your take on all this. What does all this mean for you? What are we going to do about it? In the second half hour, Ann Voights and I will look at the selected cases from the recently completed Supreme Court session. And again, we once again will welcome your take on all of this. What does all this mean to you? What does all this mean here at home in the Bay Area? Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Please bear in mind our guests are here to educate and inform you about these legal issues of the day. They can't provide you legal advice on particular cases. And their opinions might not be necessarily those of the station, NPR, the various bar associations that keep this show going, certainly any of the employers or clients of the guests. Dean?
And let me introduce our guest tonight. Ann Voights has been a frequent guest on our show. She's a partner at the firm of King & Spalding. She's worked on cases before the United States Supreme Court, the California Supreme Court, and she previously served as a clerk for both the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal and the United States Supreme Court, and worked as a federal prosecutor. And welcome once again to the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Here, Ann. Welcome. Good to see you once again.
And Ann, let me start the conversation. We've been talking about the Dobbs decision. Probably one of the most publicized and reacted to decisions in decades. It overturned Roe versus Wade, which the Chief Justice had previously characterized as a super precedent. But it did a lot more than that, didn't it? It changed the Supreme Court's whole approach to constitutional rights.
I think that's right. And it's been interesting, right? In the polls that have come out since Dobbs came out, there's been a significant drop in approval of the Supreme Court. So I think it certainly shifted public perception. And I think it's raised real concerns, particularly when you look at Justice Thomas's concurrence, about where the limits are for this new approach. You know, Justice Thomas, you know, said basically this concept of substantive due process that, you know, that Dobbs essentially does away with encompasses things like the right to gay marriage, you know, the right to privacy, the right to contraception, all sorts of other rights that didn't, you know, that the majority opinion went to pains to claim were not at issue. But I think we'll see that those are going to be some of the new areas. You know, Senator Cruz just was giving an interview where he said he absolutely thought that the decision Obergefell approving gay marriage was in fact, you know, subject to attack.
Yeah, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong about this. I think that part of the reason that the Supreme Court has lost a lot of its legitimacy and respect is just the what we might call a callous tone in these opinions. I mean, essentially they're saying, oh, yeah, okay, it may be that if there's no right to abortion, that women are going to go back and seek dangerous procedures in very questionable facilities, and that may be harmful, and that may be bad public policy, and that may be dangerous to women. But we don't care. I mean, that's not our job to decide. That's going to be up to legislatures. And if legislatures in one state want back alley abortions and legislatures in other states want a guaranteed right to reproductive freedom, that's their business. It's just not our concern.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this, you know, it's very clear in the majority opinion, their focus is on what happened, you know, centuries ago, and very little care or constitutional attention to what is happening now or what the consequences are now.
Which is really ironic when you apply it and start thinking about so many arenas that didn't exist. The technology wasn't there at the time that the Constitution was formed. There was no right to contraception because contraceptives didn't exist. Does that factor into this reasoning at all?
I think part of what's interesting here, right, is that, first off, these are lawyers and judges, not historians. And one of the problems with historical analysis is that if you frame the question in a certain way, you get the answer that you may be looking for. And that may not actually be the accurate answer or the true answer. You know, I'm sort of reminded, Naomi Wolf wrote a book a while ago that was founded on a pretty fundamental historical mistake. And I think we run the same risk when we have judges imitating historians here.
Yeah, it just seems to me there are whole layers of problems here. The analysis that we see in Dobbs and a number of other cases is strictly historical. We go back to what the founding fathers would want. And it almost seems like the Supreme Court's motto is WWFFD. What would the founding fathers do? Well, A, the founding fathers, even though they were obviously brilliant men, and they were all men, of course, they really were the founding fathers. They weren't necessarily paragons of moral virtue. I mean, some of them were slaveholders. I mean, secondly, they didn't have a crystal ball either. I mean, how could they anticipate in writing freedom of the press into the Constitution that the press would include the internet, social media, television, cable TV? I mean, isn't the job of the Supreme Court really to take that outline and apply it to modern problems?
Absolutely. And I think you've seen them do it in contexts like, say, take the Fourth Amendment, right, where we're now dealing with, for example, cell phones, which were far beyond the ken of any founding father. They certainly couldn't have imagined that you would carry around something smaller than a book that would contain, you know, libraries on libraries of information and incredibly personal information. But we have learned in the criminal context to adapt, you know, the very broad language of the Fourth Amendment to these new technologies, to these new circumstances. And so it's interesting to sort of contrast the approach courts have taken in that context with the approach taken in some of these other decisions that focus so exclusively on what happened in the past without thinking about how to apply it to our present.
Are the implications of these recent decisions suggesting that all of those are in jeopardy? That we might go back to a day where searching, where in the old days might have meant arresting you and hitting you, and now they're applying that and saying, well, you never had a right to a phone back then, and the information in it, well, so what?
No, I actually think, you know, when it comes to the Fourth Amendment, and it's interesting in some of the criminal cases, that while this is a very conservative court, there are some areas of criminal procedure and criminal law where they are, you know, reaching decisions that one might not necessarily view as strictly conservative. I think you see that in particular with the Fourth Amendment, but you also see it in some of the cases that are coming up. You know, when you look at, when they push back on what they view as prosecutorial overreach when it comes to the definitions of crimes or applying, you know, federal statutes to conduct that hasn't typically been thought of as a federal crime.
Yeah, could it be, I've wondered about this, could it be that the Supreme Court is staying away from the criminal procedure area, largely because, in part at least, because some of the most innovative criminal procedure decisions were actually Justice Scalia's decisions. And he was the godfather of historical analysis. And I'm thinking Crawford versus Washington, in his opinion, upholding, you know, an extensive right to confrontation and cross-examination. He goes back to English common law, to the 16th century, the 15th century. And that's exactly the kind of stuff that the conservative wing of this court loves. So maybe they're staying away from it because they like the analysis.
It could be that, or I think it also can just be a factor of what gets brought to their attention, right? I mean, they have discretion over their docket. They take fewer cases than they have in the past. I mean, there's a famous article, I'm going to say it was about 50 years ago, called 100 Cases a Year. Now they hear significantly less than that. And so there are a lot of important questions that only really get threshed out at most in the courts of appeal, you know, if there. And oftentimes in the criminal system, because of the prevalence of plea bargains, sometimes they don't even make it to the appellate courts.
Isn't Jeff right that some of that criminal procedure is ripe for overruling, like the exclusionary rule and Miranda? Because I could just see the six justices saying, oh, well, that's some fancy remedy that a modern court invented. I mean, Ben Franklin would never suppress relevant evidence. So why should we? I mean, that's bound to happen, right?
Actually, I don't think that's terribly likely. It is interesting, right? They did issue a decision saying that Miranda violation could be the subject of a 1983 suit, but that didn't touch the question of whether a Miranda violation, whether the exclusionary rule still applies to that. And they had already, this was some time ago, but they'd already considered the question about whether to overrule Miranda and granted with a different court and declined to do so. I suspect that Miranda, for now, is so embedded in the culture that it's unlikely to go the way of Roe versus Wade or some of the other decisions we've seen get discarded.
One of the things we've seen generally when it comes to the Fourth Amendment and, to a certain extent, most of the other amendments, most of the other rights that are granted explicitly in the Constitution, is that the Constitution does not provide any remedies. So from that perspective, when you look at landmark cases, in criminal law, for example, that talks about whether your statements can be used against you when they're taken in violation of your admonition, or illegally seized evidence can be used against you, but also in civil cases, such as when you sue the police for violating some of your basic civil rights, it seems like those remedies are going away and that there may be less substance behind the laws that protect your rights. Do you agree?
Interesting. I think, it will be interesting to see what happens. That's one area where I'm sort of reserving judgment as to what may come. It will be interesting also to see what happens. This is going to be a new court in the fall. Justice Breyer retired, and we now have one of his former clerks replacing him, the first Black woman on the court. So it'll be interesting to see what happens to the dynamic then. The addition of a justice and retirement of another one, I think, always changes the chemistry a bit. And it'll be interesting to see how that affects the way they approach cases.
Now, how do you think that's going to work? I just find the dynamics of the Supreme Court sometimes fascinating. But one of the most fascinating aspects was that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was about as far out on the left side of the court as you can get, was best friends with Justice Scalia, who was on the right end. You wonder if perhaps our new justice is going to pull Amy Coney Barrett aside and say, look, no, maybe you're a little far out on the fringe. Could that happen? Is that something that is within the internal dynamics of the court?
So I think ultimately numbers are numbers, right? And the fact is that she replaced, this doesn't change the breakdown between six conservative justices and three not so conservative justices. But having said that, I do think that those relationships make a difference around the edges, right? Maybe it means that in a particular decision, they don't go as far as they might otherwise, or maybe they agree to a middle ground that is less drastic. We saw that attempt, I think, in Chief Justice Roberts' concurrence in Dobbs, right? He was trying to say, look, we don't have to go this far. We can simply uphold this statute. We don't need to throw out Roe versus Wade and Casey at the same time. But obviously he had no one else bought into that idea. And so I think you see a chief who in some ways is chief in name only. He is not the one who is driving this particular bus.
Yeah, I think that's the area for compromise and for discussion is the sort of institutionalism of some of the justices. The Justice Roberts has always been famous for protecting the institution and the regard for precedent and stability, neutral principles and so on, deciding cases. So perhaps there's some hope there.
It'll be interesting to see what happens. I saw an article that I have to admit I did not think was likely to happen, where they were proposing that Chief Justice Roberts should resign and allow President Biden to appoint a successor. I don't think that's going to happen at all. But I do think when you look at what cases they choose to take, and in some cases how they resolve them, you may see some concern from what I call the institutionalists, who aren't just limited to Chief Justice Roberts, but the ones who really are concerned about the way that the Supreme Court is perceived. And I think that concern is well-founded.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Jeff Hayden, joined tonight with tonight's co-host, Emmy-nominated legal and political analyst Dean Johnson. Tonight, we're talking about recent Supreme Court decisions, not just the decision striking down the right to abortion, but going on to the next half hour and concluding that discussion, and then moving on to take a look at what else the Supreme Court has done over the past year and what's in the pipeline. Please join us in our discussions with appellate attorney extraordinaire Ann Voights. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the Bay Area, call us toll-free, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. You want to talk about the Supreme Court the last year? You want to talk about where this is going? You don't have to jump into our conversation where we are. And again, that number is 866-798-8255. Do you think the new makeup, having Justice Breyer retire and having his successor, do you think that's really going to change anything?
Well, I think it'll be interesting to see, particularly, you know, I know one of the topics we were going to cover was sort of what happens to the administrative state under this court. And I think Justice Breyer was perhaps one of the most, you know, one of the strongest advocates for the administrative state. It will be interesting to see if his former clerk, you know, takes the same approach. I suspect you may be slightly more skeptical than Justice Breyer was.
Yeah, I've also, though, I was just going to say, having studied the court for quite some time, I have the expectation that Justice Breyer was pretty unique in his ability to work with the other side and maybe moderate things. Maybe that's a little more questionable after Dobbs. I don't know if somebody starting out would have that same level of credibility and know how to work the margins so well. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it certainly takes time. You know, those relationships are built over decades, you know, of being one of nine. So I don't think it's something that would happen immediately. It certainly would take some time. But then again, you know, the justice has, she clerked on the court. You know, she certainly is familiar with it. She's been a judge herself. I imagine that she will have no problem finding herself at ease. And, you know, it is something that the courts is very concerned about, right? The sense of collegiality, the importance of it. You know, it was interesting. There was a report that came out in the press where they said, oh, you know, Justice Sotomayor can't participate in the oral argument. They claimed it was because Justice Gorsuch was refusing to wear a mask despite having been asked to by Chief Justice Roberts. And the court took the unusual step of actually issuing a press release refuting that because it was important. And Justice Sotomayor said no, that she was actually very good friends with Justice Gorsuch. And it was an interesting, you know, it was a fairly minor story that I don't think would have gotten a great deal of attention, but it was the fact that they went out of their way to respond to it and to emphasize how cordial they were. That was interesting. We'll see particularly what's happening after the Dobbs leak. Obviously that opinion was leaked well before it came out. That was we can't say it's entirely unprecedented, but it certainly isn't something that happens commonly or even frequently. And it launched an investigation. Who knows if we'll ever hear what the results of that are. But I think that certainly probably strained relationships within the building as well.
You know, Brian from San Francisco, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hello. Yeah, I was just curious. I know when talking about Justice Thomas, his remarks on Dobbs, he'd mentioned a few prior cases. The one that really stuck out to me was Lawrence versus Texas. A lot of people have talked about Obergefell versus Hodges. I was curious, what do you think is the real possibility that Lawrence versus Texas could be reconsidered and the risk of states recriminalizing homosexuality in general?
And actually, as my guest will probably point out in a moment, Lawrence goes a bit beyond homosexuality, but a lot of sexual acts that are performed within the home were being looked at under the previous precedent, Bowers v. Hardwick. Ann Voight, would you like to take that answer that question about what's the likelihood that they may look beyond Lawrence v. Texas and try to revive some of those earlier doctrines?
Sure. Well, yeah. I think it's interesting. You've had some Texas officials who've indicated their willingness to defend the statute that was an issue in Lawrence and try and revive it. I think there are certainly, you know, politicians who viewed Justice Thomas's concurrence as an invitation, right, as a roadmap to what to attack next. How successful they'll be, I think, will be interesting. You know, we just had the House of Representatives pass a bill, you know, confirming the right to gay marriage, you know, and it had some significant, not universal, but it did get some significant support from Republicans in the House. So we'll see if they're willing to take on that issue and how courts are willing to receive it.
Yeah, you know, I think Lawrence is a great case to bring up because, it talks about the role of precedent in stare decisis. As you remember, Lawrence was a case where Justice Kennedy did a lot of soul searching, and he said, you know, this court has not previously appreciated the significance of same-sex relationships. There's been a cultural change, and we have more data now, and so we're overruling our previous precedents. I think I see this conservative court, if they get the chance, perhaps seizing on that and saying, look, if we can look at cultural change, well, we think there's been a cultural shift in this country. And again, and we're sort of back where we started. We want to endorse the conservative view of the cultural shift now. And so we're going back to the beginning. And we don't have any problem doing that because, as Justice Kennedy said, we can do that when we get more anytime we get more data.
Brian, thank you for joining us. And just to put your mind at ease, Dean was not suggesting that the court should bring up Lawrence v. Texas. He was suggesting that for purposes of our conversation, it's a good vehicle for our conversation to move along and to understand the doctrines that they've been espousing.
But yep, somebody has to bring up the issue. They can only decide the cases they get. But I think you can count on the fact that out there in red America, there are people who are just running to the courthouse to bring these cases. So
yeah.
Let me jump in for a moment.
Hold on something that you said? I'm sorry. Go ahead, Josh.
I was going to say, let me jump in and see if we can get one more caller in before we break for this caller ID or for the station ID. William from Belvedere, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yes, thank you very much. There's something that troubles me, and maybe the guest could comment on it. I'm a retired doctor, and doctors often, when there's difficult things, they begin to refer to Latin names and things like that. That kind of separates themselves from the suffering of the patients involved. And when I hear you discussing things like, these two justices, although they were on opposite sides of the issues, they used to go to the opera together, whatever it is, I would urge the guests to focus on the fact that people's real lives are really impacted, and often impacted in terrible ways, by these kinds of the kinds of decisions that are coming out of the court now. Try to get away from the ivory tower on Mount Olympus kind of approach to things, please. Please, I would urge you to do that.
Thank you. No, I agree. I think there are absolutely real world consequences for all of us in these decisions. And I think it is oftentimes easy to get lost in the doctrine and forget about those real practical consequences. I think one of the things that is really positive about having Justice Brown Jackson on the court, for example, is she's a former public defender. So she has real experience in the criminal justice system, which I think brings a different perspective than if you are only looking at it from the theoretical approach of someone who, you know, took criminal procedure in law school, has been a judge, but has never actually had to sit with someone and talk to them, for example, about when they have to report to prison and what the consequences are for them.
And this is not something that's abstract for me or for anybody who's involved in this program. We've made a point of not only talking about the legal issues from the 20,000 foot perspective, but taking that 20,000 foot perspective and then asking, what can we do? What should we be doing? And a lot of our shows have been calls to action, and deliberately so. I personally am part of the task force that's looking at the my county's response to Dobbs and what we can do to ensure reproductive rights. And in fact, if you tune in a couple of weeks, we're going to have some members of that task force on the show, and we'll be talking precisely about exactly what we can do about what is undoubtedly a humanitarian crisis.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7, San Francisco Bay Area. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
And before I jump back to another call, I know that Dean had an unfinished thought that I wanted to give you a chance to finish before we jump into callers.
Well, I just wanted to say, you know, don't think this is anything like abstract. You know, I've been fighting for civil rights since I was 16 years old, and this is just another stage in the battle. And we're going to be involved, and this show is going to be involved, because we're going to bring in the people who are responding to Dobbs here in California. And as always, our most important question is not what does the law say, what's happening in the law, but what do we do about it? And how do you stand up for your legal rights? And with that, I'm going to be bowing out for the last half of our show to join our San Mateo County Task Force and discuss our response to Dobbs.
Dean Johnson, thank you for joining us. And before I let the matter drop, William, I wanted to assure you that is why we are taking calls tonight. That's why we're encouraging callers tonight. We want to know how it affects people in their daily lives, what it means to people with boots on the ground. Thank you for joining us, and happily, thank you for bringing us back to earth a little bit. Let me turn it to Elizabeth from Richmond. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. I am calling to find out, it's about the decision, Shin versus Ramirez, where a man whose name is Barry Lee Jones was sent back to death row. The Supreme Court reversed the previous decision. What does the legal community think about a decision like that? And what can be done by the legal community about a decision like that? If justice is about innocence, and a clearly innocent man has been sent back to death row, with his only option being a pardon by the governor of Arizona. And I'll take my answer off the air.
And that seems to be a good illustration of what William was just talking about a moment ago. The Supreme Court makes decisions based on legal doctrines, but these are real lives. How do we get back to a place where they realize, look, if somebody didn't do something, who cares about states' rights? Are we really going to say it's okay for a state to execute somebody that's factually innocent?
I think that's where, you know, you get caught up, I think, sometimes in the procedure. So just to give other listeners who may not be familiar with Shin versus Ramirez some context, the question there was whether a federal court on habeas can conduct an evidentiary review of a state court conviction based on state post-conviction counsel's ineffective assistance. And Justice Thomas reversed 6-3. As you might guess, it was Justices Sotomayor, Breyer, and Kagan in the dissent. And it really was, you know, it gutted a lot of precedent on ineffective assistance of counsel claims. Again, for listeners who may not be as familiar, you have a constitutional right to effective counsel. But vindicating that right is often very difficult. I think many people may have heard of the case with the sleeping lawyer in a death penalty case. So there are many great and terrific committed criminal defense lawyers, and there are some who are not so good, and even very good ones who make mistakes. So I think one of the things is you would see with Justice Kennedy, at least in some death penalty cases, that he would be willing to consider some of the real world consequences. And I think you don't see that as much with this particular court. And so the principle gets construed without regard to the actual consequences, whether for an individual prisoner or for criminal defendants more generally. It's one of the real changes. You know, you had Justice Kennedy, who I think appreciated history, but at the same time was really sensitive to changes in the way that our culture and society function, in the things that matter to us and the things that are important. He now has two clerks on the court, in Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh, who've taken a very different approach to the way that history constrains the analysis that we take and to whether we consider those consequences, for whether it's for criminal defendants or society more generally.
Elizabeth, thank you for joining us and for bringing that up. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Jeff Hayden. In the second half of the show tonight, we're looking more broadly at the last year, the Supreme Court's recently concluded session, some of the other things they've been doing, and taking a look at what they did, what's in the pipeline, and what it means for all of us. We encourage your call. Come call, give us a call, talk to our appellate attorney, Ann Voigt. If you have any questions, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside the Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can talk about any topic, anything related to tonight's topic. You don't have to jump in right where we are in the conversation. And let me turn it to Karen in Oakland. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. I have noticed that many politicians, journalists, and legal scholars refer to the majority in the Supreme Court as conservative, and I would like to beg to differ. I think there's one conservative, and that's among those six, and that's Roberts. The other five are reactionary, and considering what they just did with the past three or four rulings, that's very reactionary. I would like to know why even legal scholars refuse to use the term reactionary. If Republicans can call liberal Democrats left-wing socialists, then it's for sure that these radical five are reactionary. So I'd be interested in hearing the reply, and I'll take it off the air.
Well, thank you for asking that, and thank you for joining us. I'll give you my take, and then I'll turn it to Anne to give you hers. From my perspective, we use the word conservative very, very broadly and cover numbers of schools. We have social conservatives, and it seems like that's what we're developing on the Supreme Court these days, people that want to look to an earlier era before all this change came in and confounded things. They look at life as very structured. They have a very strong Judeo-Christian view of society, and they are social conservatives. We have libertarians who basically want to shake the government off their back, and various permutations of things that we consider conservatism that all fall under that umbrella. And it does cloud the analysis, as you suggested. So I think that to the extent that one broad brush confuses things, you bring up a very valid point. Anne, how do you feel about that?
So I agree. And I thank you very much for calling in and making that point. I appreciate it. Yeah, I think there's the sense of conservative, right, in the sense of not taking drastic action. I think it's fair to say that doesn't describe the majority, aside from possibly Chief Justice Roberts. And then there's conservative in the sense of socially conservative, as Jeff referred to. But there, you know, this is not a court that shies away from overturning decisions that they don't like. And it can feel, I think, to many as if there's sort of there were guardrails before, right? If a decision had been made previously, then it was that much harder under the principle of stare decisis to overturn it, even if you didn't like it. The idea was you were supposed to follow it, barring sort of limited circumstances. But now you see, you know, and it's not just Dobbs. You know, there was the school prayer case out of Washington, where the court threw away the Lemon Test, which had been in place since 1971, I think. And so, you know, we were commenting earlier, this was not a good Supreme Court term for cases from the 1970s. But they overturned it and replaced it with a different test. So this is, you know, I think some of the assumptions we had built in about how far this particular court would go have been proven to be wrong. There are a number of academics who wrote pieces when various justices were up for confirmation saying this justice or your, you know, this judicial candidate, you know, will not go this far. They will respect Roe. They will do all of the, you know, they will not do all of these things. And in fact, it turns out they did.
Karen, you might enjoy a series of books. I gave them to Dean Johnson for his birthday recently. Three books by a single author, Benjamin Ward: The Conservative Economic Worldview, The Liberal Economic Worldview, and The Radical Economic Worldview. If you can get your hands on those and read them, I can almost guarantee you at least one of them will make you angry. So I did get an interesting question from a caller. We had one, and I had one caller I was about to call in who just dropped off. We did get an interesting question passed along, though. Where are we in terms of equal protection as opposed to separate but equal? I mean, we all know that years ago, Plessy v. Ferguson was overruled in favor of Brown versus Board of Education, and we thought separate but equal was gone forever. Is there any likelihood of returning to that? I mean, after all, our founding fathers would have been fine with separate but equal as an interpretation. They never dreamed that we would have Asian Americans, Latino Americans, much less African Americans, that are treated as equals. We're all equal today. But is it likely that that viewpoint might change, at least in parts of the country?
So interesting. I don't know that it will change. I do think we are going to see, I think it will be interesting to see what happens. Next term, the Supreme Court has affirmative action cases in front of it in the educational context. You know, can a university give preference to or take into account under existing precedent, can it take into account an applicant's race? And I think a number of people are fairly worried about what's going to happen, whether those programs, whether race-conscious admission will be able to continue.
Some of the other things that we were talking about before going on air, some of the other cases, one of them talked about religious subsidies. This is a case out of Maine that I read where Maine was differentiating in terms of money that it gave out between religious schools and other schools. Tell us a little bit about that and where it all leads.
Sure. So I think it's interesting. You know, there's sort of two interesting religion cases from the last term. There's that case, which is Carson versus Maine, which essentially said, look, if the state's going to, you know, pay for people to send their kids to private school, they can't categorically take religious schools out of the mix. Religious schools have to be considered in the same way. You know, then there was this case that we referred to earlier, this Kennedy versus Bremerton School District out of Washington, which was the football coach holding a prayer on the 50-yard line after high school football games. And I think the takeaway from both of those cases is that if there are rights that this court is going to vigorously enforce, they're likely to be religious ones. And possibly also the Second Amendment, you know, that in the Kennedy case, you had a really interesting dispute just over the facts between the majority opinion and then Justice Sotomayor, who included a picture in her dissent of what this supposedly private prayer on the school football field looked like. And as you might guess, it was not actually all that private, and there were a lot of people there. And so it was an interesting dispute over how you were going to characterize the facts in a way that would support one position or the other. Because what the majority characterized as a private moment of worship didn't look so private when you actually saw the photograph of what actually happened and thought about it in the context of a high school where, you know, there can be tremendous pressure to join a group.
What we use in common usage, we refer to the phrase separation of church and state, but in actuality, the Constitution has neither that wording. What it refers to is either the free exercise clause that the state can't do anything to block the free exercise of religion. And similarly, the Establishment Clause, which says the state can't establish a state religion. And it seems that we're entering an era where the tension between those two different approaches, which had been harmonized for a long time, seems to be jumping out.
Yeah, I think it's going to be an interesting area in particular to follow. I think if you are looking for areas that are going to change a lot, you know, we've talked about some of them already. Obviously, the way we think about substantive due process now has done a U-turn after Dobbs. I think the First Amendment and in particular the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause are another area where we're going to see some significant change. And then I think finally, you know, the question of what agencies can do is going to be a really significant area.
Well, when you talk about agencies, we're talking about some of the most powerful agencies of the federal government that are in the executive branch. We don't necessarily think of them in terms of branches, but when you're thinking about such powerful groups as the IRS or the EPA or things of that nature, they've been given tremendous powers over decades, if not longer. Has that appears to be changing quickly, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And I think it's really interesting, right? Obviously, the founders never anticipated, you know, that we would have all of these agencies. But over, you know, the past century or so, we've really developed this administrative state. And courts have, for quite a long time, deferred to the decisions of those agencies, in part on the theory that Congress created them, gave them sort of certain areas of expertise. So these are all regulations that affect our lives in really sort of concrete ways, right? It's, you know, take OSHA, you know, what are you, safe working conditions? You know, take the FDA, what drugs can be sold on the market? Take, you know, the EPA, what limits can be imposed on pollution? All of these are things that affect all of us in a very everyday sense. And the question that we saw coming up this term is, how much does Congress have to do and how much can it leave to the agencies? And the before the term began, there was this real question about, okay, what's going to happen to this case called Chevron, which said, okay, when it comes to a regulation that an agency promulgates, it's in their area of expertise, courts are generally going to defer to them in their interpretation of the statute if the statute's ambiguous. So more often than not, the agency had kind of a thumb on the scale when we were looking at challenges to regulations. There was a lot of expectations that the court would sort of take Chevron head on, that it might actually get overturned, or in the alternative, it would kind of suffer death by a thousand cuts, right? It would keep getting cut back and cut back and cut back. That didn't happen. Where we saw the real pushback was in what's called the major questions doctrine. And that the major questions doctrine, you know, is sort of dates back to a couple of cases that basically said if Congress wants to give a federal agency the authority to make decisions of sort of really large economic and political significance, it has to do so really clearly. It can't sort of hint at it. It can't be oblique. It has to sort of say what it's doing. And so the question was in the EPA case, right, what they ended up saying in striking down the EPA's climate change regulations was they acknowledged in the majority that those regulations might be what they called a sensible solution to the problem. But nonetheless, because Congress hadn't, in their view, spoken sufficiently clearly, then it wasn't, it couldn't be upheld. I think it's interesting if you, sorry, go ahead, Jeff.
I was going to say, it sounds like what they're doing on an intellectual level is wresting some of the power away from some of these agencies and kicking it back to Congress. But Congress was never built with the idea of making such important day-to-day decisions on a regular basis. They sit, they debate, they contemplate things, they argue amongst themselves. And a lot of the stuff historically, at least in the last 100 years or so, has been decided at an agency level by various administrative agencies who interpret the laws of Congress, create a subset of laws, regulations within what Congress gave them. And it seems as though that's going away to a large extent, or it's certainly getting pared back. And the net effect of this is that we're all going to be living with a little less certainty, a lot less bureaucracy.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think there's a tension between, you know, Justice Kagan picked up this picked up on this in her dissent. You know, she said basically this was the court purportedly defending Congress's authority against agency incursion, but really what it was doing was it was the court arrogating the authority to be an expert to itself. So in the name of protecting Congress, you know, it was actually expanding its own power.
So we're seeing a Supreme Court that maybe eroded away some of the some of the believability of what's of what their own rulings have been, and is punting the ball away from the administration towards a more omnipotent Congress?
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, even on the, I don't think this is one that always falls neatly along ideological lines, right? We certainly saw when Trump was president, you know, a number of challenges sometimes brought by blue states against some of the administrative regulations promulgated by the agencies under his administration. You know, certainly on in the criminal law context, you see a lot of concern with the fact that an agency can promulgate a regulation, a violation of which then becomes a crime, you know, and the regulation may not be particularly accessible or understandable. And it's certainly not something that Congress itself passed on. So where that balance is and, you know, who agrees with those decisions can vary depending on the particular regulation at issue.
And it seems that they're also listening to the, as it relates to criminal stuff, the idea that while we've all heard the maxim, ignorance of the law is no excuse, what most people don't realize is breathe easy. That's meant for those laws that we're all expected to understand, not such unusually technical promulgated agency regulations. You know, let's move on from that to a very different topic. One of the big surprises of this year, nobody expected a court that was this chock full of social conservatives to jump in with a decision like Biden v. Texas and look at the laws with individual states trying to regulate immigration. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So I think, well, I guess I would say, you know, I think Biden versus Texas is an interesting case. It will be, I don't think we necessarily know, where this particular court is going to shake out entirely on immigration issues. I think you saw some decisions that were really, really restrictive of immigration rights. And then you saw others that were a little bit of a surprise.
The last case that really jumped out, we touched a little on in the first half hour, but in looking at Vega v. Tika, that was the case we discussed about 1983 case, that's litigation for monetary damages for violations of civil rights. And in that case, they looked at a violation of someone's Miranda rights to see whether that was a civil rights violation that's worthy of some kind of monetary payment. And of course, the Supreme Court said, not so fast. What do we glean from that? Is that meaning that they may have a little less teeth to the civil rights that people have? We're not just talking criminal rights, but civil rights in general? Or is that more a look at the Fourth Amendment? Where do you see that going? Or the Fifth Amendment?
So I see that as part of this larger push and pull over whether there are consequences for police or prosecutorial misconduct. We see that in the qualified immunity front. For example, whether if someone, you know, take a case of police brutality, is that something that falls in the scope of qualified immunity. So even if someone's constitutional rights were violated, it may not be actionable. They may not be able to get any relief in the court because the right may not be clearly established. You know, I think what you see there, I don't think there's any real concern that Miranda rights are going away or that they will be applied differently in the context of a criminal prosecution. But if you are looking for separate relief in a 1983 suit, obviously that's a no-go.
You know, we have a few minutes left, and I'd like to shift gears a little bit and talk about what's in the pipeline. What is the Supreme Court likely to be picking up next?
Absolutely. So we've talked about, obviously, we have the affirmative action cases coming up, but one that I would also like to talk about that I mentioned earlier is this Ciminelli case, which deals with the scope of the federal fraud statutes and what it encompasses. We talked about this earlier. This is one area where even some of the conservatives have sided with, you know, or have expressed concerns with the way that prosecutions have sometimes expanded on theories of criminal liability. So I think this will be interesting to see if they decide to push back on the prosecution's theory or if they decide that, you know, they're going to take a hands-off approach to it.
The last case I wanted to talk a little bit about, looked at the Dormant Commerce Clause. Well, let's pass on that because that's going to take so long to explain to people.
Give me a minute. I bet I can do it in 60 seconds.
You've got 60 seconds.
Okay. So the question is, does the Dormant Commerce Clause, which protects, which limits the ability of states to take action that will cut back on interstate commerce. So what is the effect of a law, like in this case, that says, okay, if you're going to sell pork in our state, you know, regardless of where you raise the pigs, they have to be raised in these certain living conditions. Is that something that a state can constitutionally do, or does that impact other states in a way that violates the Dormant Commerce Clause? So there you go. But it's a really interesting question because you've seen this tension between different states that have tried to enforce their policy preferences. And the question is, what are the limits on their ability to do that? I think that might have been like 65 seconds, so I apologize.
I think you actually came more like 55 seconds. We're getting very close to the end. Let me take Chris from San Francisco. Chris, we have less than a minute, so we have to go very quickly.
All right. I'll try and make it quick. I am curious, you mentioned the kind of strong Judeo-Christian freedom protection, and I was wondering about your thoughts on the ability to leverage freedom of religion with the acknowledgement and incorporation of Native American beliefs as a way of expanding that beyond the Judeo-Christian like strength that's in the court now. And I'll take your comments off the phone.
Chris, thank you. If I understand you correctly, I'm going to tighten that up really quick. We've talked about a court that is very active in protecting the free exercise clause. Are they going to limit it from a very narrow view of Judeo-Christian religion, or do you think that they will broaden it to encompass non-Judeo-Christian beliefs, whether it's Islamic or Buddhist or Native American, whatever it may be?
So I suspect that they are going to approach it more broadly. The question again, you know, and I think, can't remember if it was you or Dean who made this point earlier, is that, you know, they don't pick cases out of the blue. The cases have to come to them. So it's a question of what challenges are brought and by whom, and how they fare on the courts.
We have about a minute left for any closing thoughts you have.
Okay. Well, thank you again for having me. I think it has been a consequential term, to say the least, I think, both in terms of the case law and the way it's developed and the sort of sweeping consequences for everyone in the United States. It will be interesting to see what happens next term. You know, there are certainly some significant cases already on the docket, and I suspect we're going to see even more as we see more challenges wind their way up to the Supreme Court.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Our guest tonight has been appellate attorney Ann Voights. My thanks to Ann, and my thanks to my co-host Dean Johnson. A big thanks, actually, to Ann Voights for joining us. It's been most enlightening. Next week, we offer our bi-monthly landlord-tenant broadcast. Then a week following, a possible blue state rebellion in the works. Best of all, we take your calls and answer your questions. Our thanks to all of you for listening in and for joining us. And at the controls, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden. Be safe and have a good night.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.